Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Lofi, alongside Arbor Joe Aitken, here for another compelling conversation about trees. Joe, we're sitting here mid-May. Things are popping here in the West. How are you? How are things in the Midwest?
Things are popped. You know, it was interesting. I think the last time we recorded, crab apples were still holding tight. Ash trees didn't even leaf out yet. So Michigan, north of Detroit, ash trees are half leafed out. Oaks are half leafed out. Maples are just about ready, all done. Done flowering. I even seen helicopters coming down today.
Oh, really?
So I'm like, huh. I was sitting in the back. I was messing around with one of our tools in the back, in my backyard, and took a break, took a drink out of Gatorade. It was a real nice day, 75, 78, sunny. And I seen helicopters coming down. I'm like, wow, we're coming. Apple trees have already passed bloom. Lilacs are in bloom. Grass looks great. Ton of rain. Everything's dark green. Just, I think spring's sprung.
That's awesome.
I think it's here to stay.
That's awesome. We got Denver hit 2.5 inches or something last week. And then even at the ski resort that we live by, they picked up 5 or 6 inches of snow. And then the next day, like 2 inches of rain.
Wow.
So we still have, I mean, there's the snow will be on the tops of the mountains for a while here, but at about 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, just you find it on the north side of buildings and just a few spots. But spring has sprung. What did I see today? I saw a couple aspens on the south side of a house starting to pop. And then, you know, willows. They start on those cloudy, kind of cloudy, overcast days. The last couple days that the yellows really started to go. And then today it's just like they all of a sudden we hit 70 and boom. Here we go. Spring is here.
That's pretty cool. You know what? I heard something today. I was listening to Brian, Grand Arbor Group. He's trying some interviews on their social. And a good friend of ours, Mike O'Connor, he's big into bees. He said something today on Brian's social post about, if you think about pollinators, you know, we always think about the bumblebees and flowers, but he was telling us today that pussy willow and maples are the first flowers out, and that's the first plant that bees and pollinators go to in the beginning of the year.
Interesting.
So we don't, you know, I don't think we in arboriculture, I know that it's proper practice not to. Because you and I are in plant healthcare, we stay away from applying any systemics or topical applications while plants in bloom.
Mm.
But I don't think because it's not showy, like a real bright pink, beautiful, or a white flower, I wonder if people actually would treat those trees, not knowing that that is a flower and they are a initial food source for pollinators.
Yeah. That's a good question. And I suppose it would, you know, what are they treating for? I don't know the pests that affect those plants, but man, that is interesting.
What about early in the season?
Like ambrosia beetles or
scale
something.
Or yeah, something yeah, they're trying. Sure. Maybe even a hort oil.
Yeah.
I don't even think you're supposed to use a horticulture oil during
when pollinators
flowering.
Are present.
I would think it would affect the oil would you be able to get the pollen off the stamen if it was covered in oil? Or it's got to be something. I still would be cautious of using a hort oil on a flowering plant.
Yeah, I probably would too. You just kind of made me smile because I was thinking, not at the detriment of our pollinator friends, but a lot of people apply a product called Florel this time of year to help. Exactly. So Florel, for any of the listeners, is a product that you could spray to reduce the fruit on that plant that you're treating. But it's such a tricky deal because the flower has to be at the perfect stage. The whole tree has to be flowering at the exact stage. and then it still might not work. So
yeah, that's I played around with it early in my arboriculture career with very little success. So it's an interesting point of trying to stop one thing. And I know there's injectables also, but that might be an interesting topic one day when we want to nerd out on plant growth regulators.
Yes.
And the effects on, well, you know what, if you, that's what that's, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on. I don't apply them very often. So I don't want to, what do you call that? Open my mouth and put my foot in it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do a little more research on that. But, you know, things good. Spring's going on. Another interesting thing is I was taking a break. I ran the supersonic air knife on and off for most of the day. I got the compressor, so I'm going to try to get as much done as I can. I have a spot in the backyard. It's probably 20 to 30 foot round area where my dogs have destroyed the backyard. Digging to the other side of the world.
Oh, yeah.
And then the rain, the compaction. And believe it or not, it was so hard that I had a hard time getting the air knife to penetrate that hard crust, very similar to a clay soil. So I messed around with a bunch of other tools like the supersonic air knife, the LT and the LTL, which is with moisture. And it was fun. In the long term, it actually helped out. But in the short term, all I did was make a mud pie.
Oh, sure.
Which was fun.
Yeah.
I got muddy. And I you know you're going to get dirty. But I was taking a look. Now, this goes back to what kind of what we were talking about. I have an ash tree in my backyard. I'm 30 miles from ground zero with Emerald Ash Borer. And I believe that some compounds came to the market at the right time, at the right time of the curve where that tree was treated, probably 2008, 2009. And I haven't touched it since as far as treatments. I've been monitoring it. But the pressure dropped. Ground zero. There wasn't a lot of Emerald Ash Borer for all these years, Corey. Well, last year, Emerald Ash Borer found it again. And I, you know, the canopy dieback, and it was on the backside. Took my drone and spotted there was something dead in the canopy, so I climbed it. And then a woodpecker. So I'm like, oh my God, I think I got Emerald Ash Borer again. So I go back there, sure enough. But the reason I wanted to bring this up is that while I was playing around with the air knife, I kind of sat back on the log swing and I'm relaxing for a minute. And I look up and it looked like fall in spring and all the green leaves are falling off.
Oh, no.
Thinking, oh, my God, what's going on? I expected anthracnose this year in a lot of plants.
Yes.
So I think we're going to have a bad, serious year of leaf disease. And not just on deciduous, but evergreens, too. I think it's going to be a big disease year because of the ton of rain everybody got early in the season. So we're already seeing ash leaf curl from anthracnose, and they're not even fully emerged yet.
Wow.
But the leaves are falling. Now, I think my ash tree has petiole borer also.
Oh.
So the reason I bring this up is that we're talking about, you know, treating. When is it? When do you treat for everything all the time? Do you know what I mean? You're in a urban landscape. There's a tree. Now, here's a plant in the landscape that has three issues. You can't treat for everything every year.
Well,
is that considered overkill?
It depends. You know, this is just kind of, you know, you and I are just kicking it here. I would look at something as, what is that treatment threshold? And what does that pest cause to the plant in the long run? I mean, something like anthracnose, it causes premature leaf drop. Yeah, you certainly don't want that year after year because the plant needs those green leaves to bring in carbs. But I think that's a great topic. I think a lot of business owners and a lot of people who are out there just to make a buck, to spray a tree or drop product into the ground or into the tree, I think they really need to take a step back and think about, what are we managing? what's the overall objective and what's that threshold? Can you have 10%, 20% of that canopy die back, or does it have to be pristine? Or, you know, is it the backyard tree at, you know, Billy Bob's house? He's got 100 trees, or is it in the front of the White House? Where is it?
But that's a great point. It's not, sometimes it's not up to you and I.
That's right.
It's up to that person, that homeowner, that client that called you, and what is their expectation?
Right.
I want that thing. I don't want a leaf to fall off that tree. Well, you and I know that we can't control that 100%. But so that was what I was thinking. It's my tree, and like a mechanic's car is always backfiring and looks terrible because you have to work on cars all day long. It's tough to get motivated when you come home and spend time with the family. I think I probably neglect my trees because I do trees, or I'm talking about trees for a living. And then when I get home, I just want to relax.
Right.
So maybe, you know, you're right. Threshold. What is going to kill that tree?
Or what can you not tolerate? Can you tolerate 10, 15% canopy dieback? I don't know. Or maybe not even dieback, just, you know, leaf drop.
Leaf drop. It's early in the year. Mother Nature will put, I might fertilize it. I don't know.
I have worked, now that we're talking about it, I've worked on properties where they, I don't know if they value their tree or if they value how other people are looking at them, their property and their tree. But they would throw the whole toolbox at that. They'd listen to what you're talking about here. They'd probably air knife or air spade it out, deep root fert, plant growth regulator, throw a fungicide at it for fun, and definitely some triage or some, you know, something for the borers. But that's their deal. Then I've got customers who'd say, maybe every couple of years we'll do something.
If it dies, we'll just take it down. It's not that important.
Yeah.
That's a good point. That would be a great show one night to get a homeowner on.
Well, and for the listeners too. So Joe, when I was just kind of coming up and learning how to communicate to homeowners about their trees back in like 2013, 14, whenever I really did it for a profession as a sales arborist, man, I went through all this training and I had so much, and I was so eager, and I had all the knowledge on all these pests, and I could have proposed all those things, and I was so excited. I'd spend all this time putting together proposals and educating the customer, and man, an estimate used to take me an hour, and I'd make it perfect, only for the customer to say, I'll just take it down. I didn't really like it anyways. So as tree geeks, you know, you and I are looking at it going, you could do this. There's so much potential. But at the end of the day, Joe, you're 100% right. Like you just said, is what does the customer value? What can they tolerate? What's their expectation? So to anybody who's doing sales, arboriculture, you know, talking to homeowners, man, one of the first things is establish that understanding of what that tree means to them. If it's just a removal.
What's the value to you? Because I got all kinds of tools, but I need to know this because, you know, and it was funny is that I was in a discussion the other day with a fellow arborist, and something came up on a recommendation on social or something, but then someone chimed in, treatments are expensive. And when I hear that, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. Like, why would they say treatments are expensive? Isn't a tree removal expensive? Well, everything's expensive, but that we never established what the value of that tree was to that client before we make bold, blind, effing ridiculous comments like, that's just too expensive to treat, but I'll charge you $3,000 to take it down. It's mind boggling sometimes. Don't get me wrong. Trees have to come down, but we just have to do a better job at establishing right from the get-go. What is the value of that tree to that client?
That's so important, and I'd like to build on that, Joe. And for any of the listeners, once again, we're given this is good information. This is a good conversation. You talked about what's the value of that tree. You know, what does it mean to them? What kind of things is it providing? I would also, having the sales mindset, look at it and say, we don't know what's expensive to somebody else. What's the value of a dollar to them? Because if you approach some homeowners, they might say, oh, you know, $200 every year to treat my tree or to save my tree, that's expensive. But you might also talk to people and they'll go, oh, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 a year on my landscape, that's nothing. So it's not up to us and to this gentleman or whoever, female, whoever else is trying to sell these quote unquote expensive treatments. Is just the worst thing you can do when you're in a sales position is put yourself in that customer's position as it relates to how you value a dollar. Because it's going to be different for everybody.
You know, and this kind of links back. So for our listeners that didn't hear our podcast with Marty Shaw, you know, it goes back on the other foot. If they don't take care of it and the tree dies and falls, now they all of a sudden they want that tree's worth $1 million to them. But during that time span, how much did as Mr. and Mrs. homeowner, how much did they spend on landscape maintenance of that tree? So it was a, Marty had a really good point of view, and I learned a lot on that podcast myself. But yeah, you're right. You're right, Corey. Know your value, know your worth, put your price on it. This is what I think it's going to cost. I'm trying to be as honest as I possibly can. This is what it's going to take for me to do it. And if they say no thanks, you got to be able to walk away.
And walk away, man, we need to be doing that. I think as professionals, we got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And I don't, there are people listening to this. You don't want to climb for everybody you've climbed for. You don't want to work for everybody you've worked for. You know, if you could pick your ideal client, what would that look like? You know, somebody with a disposable income who values their trees, who's going to treat you properly, would probably be a good place to start. But I think so many people right now just commoditize. Anyhow,
I'll take it. I'm not even gonna
yeah.
try looking that one up. You roll with it, Corey.
Yeah, but they exactly. So they do that to some, you know, tree service. Oh, you're a tree service. They get 10 different estimates for this tree service. But the reality is what's going to motivate them? Are they motivated by the low price? Are they motivated by the professional who's certified, who goes to all these workshops to make sure that they're doing the right thing?
Oh
And
my God. That's
yeah,
it's funny you bring that up because we talk about I mean, throughout the last couple of years on the podcast, I talked about Steve and Paul, Steve Podgewitt and Paul Schaefer, where I got my first professional start in arboriculture with Alpine Tree Care, close in Southeast Michigan. Now, these guys came up through the Davie, went to DITS. When I started working for them, they exposed me to being a certified arborist, the professional side of it. I was talking to Steve, the owner, the other day. You know, we it's amazing after 35 years, we still chat. And maybe not that long. I'm just dating myself. But he goes, yeah, man, I just got rid of my Dodge pickup. He had his big lifted Dodge Tree Care truck, and it was pretty sweet. He goes, I just got rid of my truck. And I go, what, my God, are you gonna be okay without a truck? He goes, yeah. I bought an Escalade. I'm like, what? He goes, dude, it's loaded. It's got air conditioned seats and everything. I says, please tell me you don't drive that and go do bids in that.
No.
And he goes, oh yeah, people love it.
Oh my gosh.
And kind of what we're talking about is that as we always, I was always brought up, never drive a Corvette to a bid because they think you're gouging them. You're making too much money. Heaven forbid you're successful. But Steve turned it around and said, people want to work with successful people. And nobody says a word about my car. They want to work with somebody that's successful and knows what they know what they're doing. And there's a price on that. Does that make sense?
Nah, that
I'm
does.
just trying to put another spin on it because I thought that if I was, I would have my beat up tree care truck when I was doing sales arborist. I'd have the tree care truck. I'd be hitting them on the way home. There'd be logs in the back or brush, and it was game on. It was, you didn't have time to go home and wash up and, you know, put your suit and tie on and drive your Escalade around and do bids.
Well, and I do think there's something to be said for what standard are you going to hold yourself to? What standard is the company hold you to? I was at a talk this winter where a gentleman had the podium, and he was talking about how he's trying to do what you and I are trying to do, is raise the bar in arboriculture, really standardize and just bring our industry, you know, professionally better. And he was talking about, he would never show up to a property, to an estimate, wearing anything other than a collared shirt and a clean pair of pants. And he always showed up early and on time. And he could, you know, that was what he established. That was the clientele that he was after that was looking, or that, you know, we're looking at things like that. So yeah, not everybody, but like I said, you don't want to work for everybody. Maybe some of the listeners, or maybe your niche is going to be in that community where everybody's got a Tesla and a BMW, or maybe you've got that blue collar community where everybody's got a Ford or a Chevy, you know?
Yeah. And either one's great.
Oh yeah.
You know, but when I first got into the business working for Chaz F. Irish, the company was a 100-year-old company when I was there. That's where we talk about it, where I got my love of history and arboriculture. Chuck Irish had the way he did it is that he would not leave an invoice or a bid at the house.
Yep.
Everything came back. It was written up. It was given to the secretaries. It was all typed up on Irish letterhead across Chuck's desk. He would review it, sign it, and it would be mailed to them. Mm. And, you know, this goes back when the Chaz F. Irish had all the Ford estates.
Oh, sure.
The Dodge estates, all the big estates in the Grosse Pointe. They had the money. And they had the clientele from hard work, for years and years of hard work. And they wouldn't go out there and just give a price. He would evaluate what needed to be done. It was almost like T&M. He already had the job. So it wasn't he was bidding. And then, you know, as things changed, I would go out and try to bid a residential job, and we would try to do it the old school way on that. And by the time that we got out there in today's society, the tree was gone already.
Mm.
So I think the clients have changed, and we've talked about it in the past. You have to change with that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Because everybody wants it now.
we do live in that world. And you made me smile when you said that you used to take back those estimates, type them up and mail them, because I'm not going to name any companies. When I was in Minneapolis doing the sales arborist thing, but there were companies where I'd show up to do an estimate with five other people, six other people, whatever. And you could actually see them in the door and all this. And I've heard stories about, you know, people just reading through the estimates and beating it by a dollar, beating it by $10 or whatever, yeah, or taking the estimate and tearing it up, which, you know, I don't really have a lot of respect for. I don't have a lot of respect for any of those practices, but it just kind of made me smile, because it's like, do people still write estimates, or is everything emailed? You got to believe people are doing both. I mean, the smaller companies are probably just, you know, handwrite them, but I think a lot of people just email them, or
everything. I think you're right. I don't know. That's a great point, Corey. What do people do? Does anybody even know how to use a pen anymore?
Yeah. What's a fax-a-mile machine? What's this fax machine people talk about?
Oh my God. I haven't faxed something in 22 years. It's got to be that long.
Oh my gosh. If I needed to fax something college or beyond, you know, I would go to the library and, you know, pretty please help me. And I know it's not hard, but it's like, you know, it just, can you just text it?
I can't remember the last time. Yeah. You know what? It's, yeah, everybody's a text. Everything's an email. Everything's now. It's kind of nice though.
It is. And I'm trying to think, you know, I feel like we've talked a lot about kind of different sales tactics and techniques and professionalism on this. And I think there is a way, especially people hitting the spring, right? The companies that we're working with, they're using our products. You know, you might have a 3 to 4 week backlog, but everybody wants it now. So something that you could say is, hey, you know what? We do have a backlog because we do a good job and we take care of our clients. And that's why we have a backlog. If somebody, you know, only has 2 days of work, you know, why do they only have 2 days of work? And it could be because they're coming out of the winter. Maybe they've got a lot of staff they have to keep busy. And you know, the inverse of that is you could say, hey, we do have the capacity to get here and prune or remove these trees within the week. And then just let them know why. But yeah, it's, oh man, spring is fun.
Yeah. Well, speaking of spring, got a couple of rec climbs coming up here in Michigan. I think it's time for me to dust off my gear. You been up in the tree lately, Corey? You get a chance to, do you guys have anything like that out there in the West, out Colorado? Does your ISA chapter group ever have rec climbs? You get off the ground at all?
We do have rec climbs. I did a few when I was living in the Front Range in the Denver metro area. I do still get off the ground. I know we only have a couple minutes left, and I did a couple weeks ago. It was probably about a 18 or 20 inch aspen, and I cleaned it up for one of my neighbors, and it was good. I used the Zigzag Plus. I used the Sequoia harness from you. It was fun, but man, if you're not in production daily, I need to harden up.
Yeah, we're getting squishy. I think my boys climb more than I do. They're always, hey, can we put the stuff? So Rory the other day, every time he pulls the throw bag out, it goes right into a knot.
Oh yeah.
But he gets it up there. He chucked it. He actually got a pretty good throw. Got up there about 40 feet. First throw bag is stuck. I can't get it out. And it was over the weekend. I think it was Saturday. It's still up there. I haven't got the energy to go up there and retrieve it yet.
Is it in that ash tree? Because man, I've lost throw bags in ash trees.
That's the ash tree in the backyard we're talking about. It's stuck up there, and I'm thinking, well, Joe, you got to get up there anyways. But again, when you get up, you got your fires to put out, you got your phone calls, your emails. Next thing you know, it's lunchtime. I got to get off the ground soon. I got to make sure everything's good. Do a good equipment inspection. Not only my climbing gear, but your PHC gear. Make sure you and I will be out doing a lot of demos and instruction. Make sure our gear is top notch. Can't talk about it. You got to practice what we preach.
Maybe we should do that one of these next recordings, because we're about out of time today, but maybe we should talk about that. You know, what is the checklist for climbing gear? What do you want to go through? How often do you want to go through it with plant health care and fertilizer rigs and trunk injection equipment? What is that checklist? What does that look like? That would be a good topic, Joe.
There's daily.
Yeah.
There's weekly, there's monthly, there's annuals. So I think we had to find a couple of good reps. I think a good judge, like maybe we got to know a head judge in a climbing comp, because that's probably the most intense gear inspection.
Oh, yeah.
How do you translate that to a day to day? And then maybe I can get John Stone from MSU, who does all the teaching and classes on PHC rig safety. I'll see if I can reach out to John.
That's awesome, Josh. Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate always. I know we just kicked some ideas, kicked some thoughts. Hopefully some of our listeners found some value in the conversation. I know we have guests for the next 3 weeks. So the next handful of podcast episodes should be pretty fun, but thank you, sir. Always enjoy our time.
Right back at you, buddy.
See ya.
See ya.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.